night.
A foghorn was groaning incessantly on the sound, and I tossed half-sick between grotesque reality and savage, frightening dreams.
This is probably too hard, but we'll see.
One of my most vivid memories is of coming back west from prep school and later from college at Christmas time. Those who went farther than Chicago would gather in the old dim Union Station at 6 o'clock of a December evening with a few Chicago friends already caught up into their own holiday gaieties to bid them a hasty goodbye. I remember the fur coats of the girls returning from Miss This or That's, and the chatter of frozen breath, and the hands waving overhead as we caught sight of old acquaintances, and the matchings of invitations. Are you going to the Ordways, the Herseys, the Schultzes? And the long green tickets clasped tight in our gloved hands. And last, the murky yellow cars of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad, looking cheerful as Christmas itself on the tracks beside the gate. As we pulled out into the winter night and the real snow, our snow began to stretch out beside us and twinkle against the window, and the dim lights of small Wisconsin stations moved by, a sharp, wild brace came suddenly into the air. We drew in deep breaths of it as we walked back from dinner through the cold vestibules, unutterably aware of our identity with this country for one strange hour, before we melted indistinguishably into it again. That's my Middle West. Not the wheat or the prairies or the lost Swede towns, but the thrilling returning trains of my youth and the street lamps and sleigh bells in the frosty dark and the shadows of holly wreaths thrown by lighted windows on the snow. I am part of that. A little solemn with the feel of those long winters. A little complacent from growing up in the Caraway house in a city where dwellings are still called through decades by a family's name.
That was an excerpt from Studio 360, American Icons, The Great Gatsby, produced by Emily Botine and Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can hear the entire program on our website at thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up, the Silver, Bronze, and Director's Choice Award winners. But first, another honorable mention and a 75-year-old mystery unearthed.
Queste esperienze provarono conclusivamente che la trasmissione e la ricezione delle onde elettriche non erano affatto limitate.
Show me the family of a radio producer, and I'll show you a family who is bound to be on the radio sooner or later. What riper, richer material can there be for a storyteller? Eurydice Aroney, with producer Sharon Davis of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, dug into the dark corners of her family's history to uncover the story of her grandmother's death. We spoke with Eurydice to find out how she discovered the truth about Edna Luvilla Hayes.
When I was growing up, my grandmother was strangely absent. I remember my mother saying to me that her mother had died of food poisoning when she was 9 years old. So I had this idea of my mother being a kind of orphan. I almost thought it was romantic that her mother had disappeared. There was no photos of her, there were no stories about her, and she certainly never spoke of her childhood. And I just put it aside. The circumstances of finding out the reality of what had happened to my grandmother was when I was about 21, I think. I was living in the country and I had an abortion, and I ended up on my mother's couch. I came back to Sydney and ended up on her couch. And my mother was a feminist. And I said, "Where have you been?" she said. And I said, "Well, I've just had an abortion, so I'm not feeling too well." And her reaction was quite extreme, and I was surprised. And I think it was at that time I remember that she told me for the first time that her mother had actually died of a back-out abortion in 1942. It was one of those stories that just lay there and didn't really look at me until my mother became profoundly depressed a couple of years ago. And she started talking about her brothers and sisters, and I never even knew she had brothers and sisters. And I thought, well, maybe this has got something to do with her depression, the fact that she's out of touch with her family, that she never felt like She was loved, and so I decided to find out. When I talked to my mother about her mother, suddenly I thought, well, there's the story. There's the real story. I'm going to try and find out who this woman was, how she died, and what happened to the rest of the family, and went from there.
So what you did discover is a really complex story with lots of twists and turns, and we really, really want to encourage people to listen to the entire thing on our website. But for our broadcast, what we've done is we've picked a self-contained story within the documentary that echoes your mom and your grandmother's story. So what I'm wondering is, what led you to tell the story of Warwick Sharing, which is what we're going to hear?
Well, we really knew nothing when we started, except that she had died of an illegal abortion. So 18 months of investigation revealed quite a lot, including my family, who I hadn't known. We tracked them down and interviewed them for the program, hoping that we could use their stories to round out the story of my grandmother and their lives as well. But they got cold feet. And although, as you know, as a journalist, we had every right to use their interviews, we didn't. So we thought, well, this was a bit of a full stop to the program, because we couldn't just go with the documentation, the archives, and myself and my mother's story. Although that was very moving, it really wasn't enough. So we put an advert in the national newspaper looking for people who had stories of abortions, backyard abortions or illegal abortions during that time. And Warwick and Mary, another woman in the program, were two of the people who responded to the advert. It was funny, we put the advert in and then there was just silence, the phones just didn't ring. And then 3 weeks later, as if it took that long for people to decide, the phone just kind of steadily rung for the next few weeks. And Warwick's story, because it echoed my mother's story in that once his mother died, she was never mentioned again. He was separated from his brother and nobody ever told him the circumstances of his mother's death. Because it echoed my own mother's story, mm-hmm. That's why we decided to use that one.
This is the story of Warwick Sharing from The Search for Edna LaVilla.
I was 5 years old at the time. Sky outside was grey, so I'm assuming it was around 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't know whether I woke up because of the light from the bathroom or whether it was through my mother crying, but anyhow, I woke up, found the bathroom light on, and my mother lying, half sitting against the bathroom wall. My mother wouldn't speak to me. I thought I'd done something wrong. Anyhow, I sat down in the hallway, which looked out and onto the bathroom, and just waited there.
In the morning, the boy's uncle came to visit. Finding it all quiet, he looked through the window. Warwick says his mummy has been in the bathroom all night and he can't open the door. His uncle climbed in through a window and found Warwick and his one-year-old brother lying beside his mother's dead body. Because his father is away fighting the war, Warwick and his brother are separated, shuffled around relatives till their father's return. The trauma of his mother's death holds him tight, and it seems as if he's the only one who remembers her.
My father remarried after the war, and my mother, as far as my life concerned, didn't exist. Her death and her life weren't discussed. In fact, she didn't even have a proper gravestone at the time. The story had been spread around that she had died through lifting a lawnmower over the back fence in those days. The old push mower was quite heavy, and a lot of people apparently accepted that throughout the family. The fact that she died through trying to abort herself wasn't mentioned at all.
On Lillian Sharing's death certificate, there's no mention of her pregnancy, or that her attempted abortion almost certainly killed her. It was only when Warwick began to do family research in the 1980s that he found out the facts. And these came not from family, who certainly had known, but from the coroner's report. The electric light was on, and on the floor were two basins, one with a clear fluid-like water, the other empty. A Higginson syringe was on the floor. The post-mortem also says she was 3 months pregnant and that she died of an air embolism, which could have been caused by the use of the syringe.
Not only is it sad that it happened to her, but the fact that if you read the documents, you'll see that the doctor performing the autopsy said that she was a healthy woman. And, you know, the fact that she had to die was... I cried. I was extremely sorry that my mother had to go to that extent. You know, if abortion had been legal, she could have had the abortion carried out and she would still be alive and we would be a whole family. I don't condemn her at all because that was a choice she had to make at the time. I'm just disappointed in society forcing that on her and eventually causing her death.
Warwick's story echoed my mother's. And like him, I wasn't going to let a botched abortion and a family silence erase Edna from my mother's memory, my children's history.
The Search for Edna LaVilla, produced by Sharon Davis and Eurydice Aroney for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It received an honourable mention in the 2007 Third Coast Festival Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. To hear Eurydice's entire journey through cemeteries, hospitals, newspaper archives, and police reports in this very personal detective story, go to thirdcoastfestival.org. Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to the 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to the 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey. While listening to this box with a voice, this radio, it really doesn't matter where you are, car, house, grocery store, because once you turn it on, you are transported. Sometimes the transporting is of an emotional nature. Other times, a story seems to all but take you someplace new. And then there is the rare documentary that makes you rethink what you think you know. The winner of the Third Coast Festival Director's Choice Award does all three. Mazen Kerbaj is a musician and comic illustrator who was living in Lebanon during the 2006 conflict between Hezbollah and the State of Israel. There he kept an illustrated blog of everyday life amidst war. When radio producer Anna Burns came across Mazen's blog, she teamed up with sound engineer Lewis Mitchell to create an audio rendering of it. It's called Before the War, It Was the War. If you listen carefully, you can hear Mazen improvising on his trumpet while bombs and artillery rounds explode in the distance. ¶¶
Mazen Kabaj has lived most of his life with the idea and reality of war. He grew up in Lebanon during the Civil War. He is a musician, a visual artist, and a father. He'd been thinking about starting a blog, and when the Israeli army bombed the Beirut airport in retaliation for Hezbollah capturing two Israeli soldiers, he was prompted to actually do it. What he created was a powerful documentation of the experience of living through war.
Years of laziness before starting this blog. I'll begin then by thanking Israel, who burned in one night 2 years of efforts to avoid getting myself trapped in this adventure. Good job, guys! Especially the airport party and the bridges. No way to leave the country. Nothing else to do than this blog. After all, we all need sometimes a valid reason to start to work, and a good old war soundscape is okay as a starting point.
Not a blog for me, it's a notebook that was published on a blog, if you want. I mean, in a sense, I have no... it's just I'm using the internet as a tool to put the drawings daily and to be able to show them daily. It's more, it was more as a media rather than a blog. It was a personal media, if you want.
Night of 13th. To 14th of July 2006, 4 a.m. The Israeli Air Force flies over Beirut. Far away, we hear bombs falling down. Silence. We begin to hear shots far away. A.m. Closer explosions. Little by little, people wake up and get out on their terraces to hear where the sounds are coming from.
Mazen had been married to a French citizen and now holds a French passport. It gave him the option to leave for safety and to take his son, Evan, with him. He chose to stay.
Well, this made me think a lot because I would say without a son, I would not even have thought about leaving. And having a son was the only thing making me think all the time, like maybe it's better to leave the country. I don't want him to live the same shit that I lived, which is totally normal, you know. The more the war was settling, the more it was evident that staying at the mountain where he was, his mother, was somehow safe. So he wasn't hearing the bombs, and he was just hearing airplanes, if you want, and the bombs weren't falling close to him. To go back to this thing of leaving the country, just going 3 or 4 times during the war to the mountain and sleep there drove me crazy. I just feeling one day far from Beirut while all this was happening was driving me crazy. So how about imagining myself like walking in Berlin or in Paris or London or I don't know where and just having news by newspaper and by TV, you know.
5:02 a.m. Waiting in front of the TV. Silence. Beirut burns in the TV. Silence.
Before the war, it was the war. Winner of the Third Coast Festival's Director's Choice Award, produced by Anna Burns and engineered by Lewis Mitchell for the program Street Stories on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. You can find a link to Mazen's blog at thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to the 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast.
Sound is light. We all know that who work in it. Sound reveals. Sound touches. Sound illuminates.
One of the things I love about radio is that it lets me see things I normally don't get to see through my ears. The festival's Bronze Award winner takes us on a journey to a place few care to look. In it, the Zagars, a creative family of committed artists, explore death through art in this documentary of a man in decline. Also, just a word here, the story's not always easy to listen to. It's graphic in some parts, and it raises a number of tough questions. We'll talk with producer Lou Olkowski about some of these when it's over. Grandpa was produced for the program Radiolab, hosted by Robert Krulwich and Jad Abumrad.
This next piece was produced by Lou Olkowski. It's about one family, three generations.
Introduce myself.
This is Jeremiah, the youngest.
I'm Jeremiah Zagar.
He's a filmmaker.
Son of Isaiah Zagar.
His dad, Isaiah, is a muralist, famous muralist. And his grandfather?
I'm the grandson of Asher Zagar.
Asher Zagar is a health nut.
18, 19, 20, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
This is a video of him that Jeremiah shot of Asher doing his daily exercise routine. He's in his 90s. He's jumping on a trampoline and counting each jump.
How old are you now?
Me? I'm 90.
90?
Yeah.
You're a healthy man for 90.
Yes, and I'll be still healthy when I'm 91, 92. The great-great-grandfather that I named after lived to 102.
So you're going to live to 102?
I don't know, but maybe.
At the age of 93, Asher began to decline quickly.
How do you deal with a man dying in your house? How do you deal with that?
The family decided not to send him to an elderly care facility. Instead, they were going to attend to his dying.
Well,
not just attend.
You know, my father starts taking photos of him.
Watch.
One of my modes of understanding was either drawing or photographing.
Pictures. Constantly.
Just seeing.
Thousands of slides. Thousands.
That's how it went for a while. Isaiah, the dad, would take care of his dad and take some photos, while grandson Jeremiah basically looked the other way.
Well, I never really knew my grandfather.
But then Isaiah got an idea.
I thought to myself, challenge this young boy to this duel. Who can take the most objective photographs of a dying man?
It wasn't like we threw down and like I pulled my camera out of my holster and he pulled his camera out of his holster, you know? It wasn't like that. He was involved in my grandfather's death and I wasn't. And so he said, this is how I get involved. It's my senior year in high school, and I was a busboy in this restaurant down the street, and I loved it. And I would bus tables till 2 or 3 in the morning, and then I would get drunk with the people after work. And then I would come back, and I would take care of my grandpa. And so I would lift him up and change his sheets, because otherwise his bed sore would burn more. And he had this horrible bed sore. You can see it in the photographs. And I'd never seen anything like that before. And he would hit me while I lifted him up. And then I would photograph him because I would want to sit with him. So I start sitting with him. You know, you sit with him because you want to calm him down. And the way you sit with him, I mean, my father was right. You have the camera. I mean, that's how you cope. Otherwise, you're sitting with him and he's just looking at you.
During the contest, Dad and son shared duties of taking care of Grandpa. And at night, they'd sit at the kitchen table and compare photos.
As soon as I took the first pictures, you knew mine were better than my father's, because my father's were from far away and they were snapshots, and mine were like specific. Like, I was fascinated with him dying. I wanted to know what it looked like.
And this went on for about a month, during which time even Jeremiah's friends,
all of his friends,
got involved.
In the wee hours of the night,
he would wander down into the basement where we were playing pool.
I would wake up and I would see,
I mean, who knows what he said,
that they're surrounding my father or four or five young people. Sure, they were drinking beer and they were joking around and they were, but they were there. They were there while he was there. What I remember most was waking up and seeing you and your friends changing his sheets and lifting him and moving him around.
Yeah, Gabrielle did it with me.
Who else did it with you?
John, Lincoln.
They all became initiated into the most problematic event in our lives. And it was an amazingly rare scene to see these teenagers attending to death. Well, this is a book of photographs of my father, your grandfather's last week of life in this very room.
So it's actually 3 weeks.
Four weeks.
About a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the contest was a month long. Smart guy I am, huh?
You're good. You know how to make a contest.
I kept it going for 1 month.
Good job. So.
Isaiah, can you describe this one for me?
Well, the feet look like they were out in the desert, that they've been baked and cracked, and they're dried out.
I mean, look at them. They look like... I mean, look at the nail. The nail is wild. But, I mean, everything, it's like just wild. It's wild that the skin can do that. I think I was amazed that the skin did that. I was like, what the...
I have these same legs.
Stop touching the photos.
Well, I can almost feel him by feeling them. I'll feel you instead.
No.
That's the bed sore. That's what happens.
Oh, it was awful. Awful. Man who prided himself on his health. Look what happened. How does one describe that?
It looks like rotting meat.
I mean, they're just open wounds, and you move them around, but still, it was impossible.
It's crazy to look at the colors, too, because it's pink, and then white, and then green, and then brown, where it's
rotting. Well, the white is the muscle, isn't it? The white is the muscle.
I took these photos in color because in black and white, you'd never get it. You know, you'd never get how painful this must have been. His anus is all red. I mean, like, really red. And you can see that parts of it have broken. And there's just blood gushing out. And it's dried. I mean, the blood is dried. And then on his ass, there's a giant welt.
I think this is the last photo. Yeah. Oof. This one's tough.
You can see, like, the cognition is gone. The mouth is agape. He's buried in his pillow.
He knew it was over. It was just a matter of time now.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the closest I got to him dying.
He wanted to live forever. The fix was in from the beginning.
The fix was in? I was supposed to win?
Sure. Sure. How could it be any other way?
You could, I don't know. I could have given up. You wanted me to win?
It was a subterfuge to get you to be with your grandfather as much as possible.
I thought it was a fair fight. It wasn't. Ugh.
Can there ever be?
He knew all along that he couldn't take a good picture.
When a person is dying, it's very important that they're surrounded. They're surrounded by the light of life. And you don't go into the place of oblivion alone.
You want me to be there?
I don't know. At this point, I don't know. I'm not at that place yet. Well, what does that mean with the camera? I mean, just be with me.
Yeah.
Be with me. Be close to me. Be soft with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's what it's about, really. Mm-hmm.
Be soft with me.
Thank you.
That was Grandpa, produced by Lou Olkowski for WNYC's Radio Lab, edited by Ellen Horn. Grandpa won the Third Coast Festival Bronze Award. Now, there are parts of the story that are uncomfortable to listen to. We spoke with Lou Olkowski, and we asked her, when she first got wind of this photographic competition that the family was doing, what did she think?
I wasn't horrified at all. I don't know if that's kind of where you're going, but I know that, like, Isaiah is an artist, and all of Isaiah's art that he has done for his whole life is about him, is about his family, his wife, his children. Everyone in his life is in his work, which are in these enormous murals that cover South Philly. And we're talking images of, like, his wife, like, giving birth is, you know what I mean? Like, I've seen, like, photos in their house of, you know, Jeremiah, like, just immediately after being born, Isaiah naked, doing jumping jacks or whatever. I mean, like, I've seen, like, their family exposed. And, like, that's part of that family, is that that's their thing, you know? They are all about, like, every experience is an opportunity to make art. So I never had any of this feeling of, like, is this good, is this bad? It's like, I don't feel like that's my job. My job is to, like, get out of the way and just kind of explain, show the experience, you know, what happened and what it meant for them, you know?
Mm-hmm. There are some pretty intense images in this competition that this family was doing, and it really yielded some very graphic descriptions of death. And I'm just wondering, did you have any struggles about putting that material in the documentary?
This story is less about a competition, and it is really about a young guy, Jeremiah, like, really, really examining death, like, really wanting to understand, like, what is happening physically to the body. And if that is your context for what this piece is about, then, like, I could see no way possible to not include that descriptive tape. You know, you can't examine death if you're not willing to look at it. And in that way, I felt very responsible to not let Jeremiah down and make it sweet, pat, like, yes, I'm taking all of these pictures of my grandpa in a white sheet, and doesn't he look angelic? There were some of those pictures, you know. But, you know, here's the thing. Death is not comfortable. It is really nasty. And it's like, I'm okay with that. And I'm okay. I personally am okay with people feeling uncomfortable. I am okay if people hate it and just think how terrible it is. I'm okay with that, because I think no one really wants to see it that close.
After our conversation with Lou, she said she was hoping that it wasn't really audible to us that she had been tearing up through the interview. So before she left, I asked her why she was crying.
I think with them, there is this openness and acceptance for whatever the other is doing, especially when it comes to art making, you know? It's like, you know, that your life, you know, is really valuable, and that making art with your life is a good thing to do. So there's something in that, like, just like the lovingness of that family is just, like, overwhelms me a little bit. And they're not, like, a perfect family by any means, but, like they have an openness that, like, I don't know how to do anymore as a grown woman.
That's Lou Olkowski, producer of Grandpa, the Third Coast Festival Bronze Award winner. I'm Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to the 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Coming up after the break, the Silver Award winner. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey. We just heard The Bronze Award Winner, a story of one father's attempt to bring his family closer together. In this year's Silver Award Winner, we hear from another father who's forced to question all that he assumed to be true about being a parent. The story is called A Fragile Son, and it comes to us by way of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation program Out Front.
Houses. Chili mushrooms.
Hi, I'm Surjit Sachdev in Markham, Ontario. Welcome to Outfront.
Okay, can you move it to La Boheme, please?
Like this?
Put it on to La Boheme.
I was here.
Please put it on the lab of him.
Oh, there it is.
When he was 6 years old, one day he was just watching TV and we heard some sort of funny type of music and came over to see what he was doing. And there he had this... opera going on the PBS station. My wife and I said, oh wow, gross. What kind of shrieking noises and stuff like that is it? Now, 20 years later, we as a family love opera, and his face just goes flush. It's red, and he's so excited, and he sings along. In our household, we get a daily dosage of something like about 6 hours of, at least 6 hours of opera music.
Oh, beautiful!
We have our difficult moments as parents. I guess we have to live with that. When Kapil was young, Sammy, his mother, would take him along to teach him some independence by say, okay, let's go and do some grocery shopping. But while waiting in the lineup, he may have or might once in a while touch somebody inadvertently. And then people would just sort of turn around and make some strange comments like, why can't they be put in the group homes? Why do they have to be let loose like this? It was very disheartening for Sammy and I. It really broke our hearts. And sometimes you feel like getting up and slapping them on their face, but you don't. You just sort of turn around the other way and walk away.
Okay, now come over here, please. Now we are in the garage. Now, come over here, please. What do you think of the day?
Still come back home late.
What do you think of the day?
It's nice outside.
Yeah, so what are we going to do right now?
Grass up.
We are going to cut the grass, mow the lawn. Okay, all right. So what's the first thing we're going to do?
A good job for mom.
We must do a good job for mom. Okay, but what about the grass?
When we're done, we'll have salad.
When we're done, what are we going to do?
Let's first then have salad. Yeah.
Then we have salad. Okay, I understand that.
It's too hard.
When Kapil was like about, 6 months old, he'd be standing in the crib very firmly holding the railing and very intently looking for someone to come. He'd be very quiet. He looked so intelligent. He looked so trusting of me. And one could never think that such a beautiful, sparkly-eyed child with such a sharp gaze would be mentally challenged. You know, our biased thinking was, I am an engineer, so my son is going to be an engineer. I mean, that's how it was in our family. I mean, there was no questions asked. My dad was an engineer, I am an engineer, so my son is going to be an engineer.
Well, it's a good app for stimulants.
Okay. Now we have to check if there is enough gas in there, right?
You can't reach the gas.
Okay. Uh-oh. You're funny. Okay. Bring it over here.
A little gas. For the gas.
No, over here.
Gas in the tank. With this.
Okay. Okay. Now, would you help me pour the gas, please? Just hold this.
Gas?
Yeah, just slowly, okay?
Gas. Gas. I let the gas. Yeah. Look at that, the gas.
Right, keep your eye on it, please, because we don't want it to overflow, right?
Yeah, this is nice.
But as Kapil started to grow, I started to watch my behavior with him. And I was very tough on him, I should say. Say if we go to somebody's house, I wanted him to behave in an appropriate manner. You take your shoes off, you sit down, you don't go and sit on the floor, you can't be yelling, you can't be just talking to yourself. The idea in my mind was always to make him look normal. And he did not follow that norm. He had his own way. And I was trying to stifle that. For me, it was like, you better listen to me. If you don't listen, there's going to be a price to pay.
Okay, let's take it out. Come.
Mark, Dad.
Okay. Pull this back. Pull this lever back, please. Okay. Are you ready?
They're hard. Oh.
Okay, just hang on a sec.
Here.
Oh, please. Come over here, please, Kapil. Well, you can't let go of this.
Okay. Ah, the wind. Hold
it. Right, we got it, okay? Oh. Now we're gonna cut the grass, okay? Come on.
I grew up in India in an extremely conservative environment. My father was a totalitarian figure in the house. When he was home, it was like even the birds were not allowed to chirp. And I was the first son. I was born after 6 daughters. So he expected his son to be a shining star. And I wasn't a very easy child. But any time I didn't do what he wanted me to do, he would beat me up. My mother sometimes tried to protect me, and she'd come in between, and she'd get a blow or two herself. And my sisters were petrified, and they dare not, because father was so strict, and they dare not come in between. My mother would cry. I would cry, and then it would be over, and say half an hour later he'd feel sorry about it. He'd come and just walk by me and say, go drink some water and don't cry so much now. And that was his way of saying, it's okay, you can take it easy now, I won't beat you up anymore.
Okay, what do you think?
Looks nice. I like it. Looks nice.
Yeah? Well, I think it was a marvelous job you did. What do you think?
Yeah, I did.
You did the whole thing.
The whole thing, all over it.
Okay, now what do you think we have to do now?
Put it inside.
Okay, gently, gently.
Yeah, it's just too hot.
Yeah, I know it's hot, but when we have to do a job, we have to do a job, right?
It's parked.
Okay, it's parked. Thank you very much, Kapil, for your help.
Thank you.
I was teaching him to brush his teeth, and he wasn't listening to me at all, and his teeth were not very clean, and I was saying, do it this way, and he wouldn't, and at that moment, I slapped him. And he said, I didn't do anything wrong, Daddy. That broke me up. Because it reminded me of my childhood. And I said, how can I do what my dad did? We are not going to relive the same life. That was the moment when I told Sammy, I said, I need to go on a vacation by myself and I want to go to India. And I went to Amritsar, where the Golden Temple is. I cried for a couple of hours, I think, in the temple, and asked for forgiveness. And it sort of dawned on me that, oh my God, here I as a parent am thinking of improving my son, and I have such a narrow view of my son. He has enormous qualities and potentials that I have totally overlooked. Oh my God. I thought I was the teacher without realizing that he is the teacher and that I am that stupid pupil who had reversed the role. When I came back from India, Kapil was very happy to see me. With Kapil, he does not hold grudges against people, you see. He has no complaints about anybody else. He is one wonderful person. He's here in this world to give. Unfortunate thing is there are few takers.
I did it. How did that? Woo! I did a good job. Oh,
A Fragile Son was produced by Surjit Sachdev and Karma Jolly for Outfront, a series from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation that invites listeners to tell their own stories on the radio. It's the Silver Award winner from the Third Coast Festival Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. Here's Surjit accepting his award at our ceremony in Chicago.
He represents what's true in this life. He lives for the moment. He loves opera. In my family, nobody knew anything about classical music. We love opera, and I have to thank my son for that.
He loves to play golf. I know nothing of golf. He has some very expensive habits.
Guglielmo Marconi was a radio pioneer, sending scratchy voices through the air over oceans for the very first time. People think of him as a scientist, but he was really a magician. For what could possibly be more magical than the human voice coming out of a box and telling you a story? Now, clearly, we've come a long way from the early days of Marconi's experiments with transatlantic wireless communications. But really, a voice in a box is still a voice in a box. And what it can do? Fly through the air faster than a speeding bullet, leap tall buildings in a single bound, to say nothing of oceans. It may even be stronger than a locomotive. Most everyone, including the Nobel Committee, believe that what Marconi achieved was great science. But we know better. It was magic.
We're talking about radio.
Radio.
Meaning you do not see the picture, you hear the voice. Here's something called the vox humana. Hear the human voice.
Listen to me.
In radio.
The 2007 Third Coast Festival broadcast was produced by Roman Mars and delivered.